Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. Today, we will be talking with Professor Simon O'Mara, who is a lecturer in the history of architecture and archaeology at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the SOAS at the University of London. We will be talking with him about his 2020 book, The Kaaba Orientations, Readings in Islam's Ancient House, published by Edinburgh University Press. Professor Simon O'Mara has a PhD in art history from the University of Leeds. He works mostly on the pre-modern visual and material culture of Islamic North Africa. And we are very much happy and honored to be talking with him today. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you, Miguel. Thank you very much. Thank you for such a nice introduction. And thank you for, above all, for inviting me to join you on New Books Network. It's a network that I've availed myself of a number of recordings in the past. And although it sounds overdone, it is an honor to be here. So thank you again.
Thank you. So we usually start by asking our guests if they could tell us something about what led them to the point where they're writing this book, about something about their intellectual background or academic background or anything, or even your life background, anything that you feel might explain and ground the person whose book we're going to be talking about. Could you please tell us something?
Yes, of course, with pleasure. And in fact, by doing so, it would allow me just to modify one aspect of your introduction for me. I don't, in fact, have a PhD in art history, in Islamic art history. I got my PhD at the University of Leeds in the north of England, but I did it in Islamic studies. And the fact that I did it in Islamic studies is really perhaps the most relevant aspect of how I've made my career in the fields of Islamic art history. And that is to say that I did art history as an MA student at the University of Chicago, and I started learning Arabic there. And I was very fortunate to have professors and teachers who were encouraging me. And after doing that, I went to live in Morocco for a few years. And when I was in Morocco, I felt that I needed to know more about the Islamic side of things. I felt that if I were to return to Chicago to do the PhD aspect of the program, which I was on, I would not necessarily be engaging with readings and teachings to do with the Islam side of things. And it was really that I was interested in. I was interested in the Islam of Islamic art history. I wanted to know more and more and more about that. So that's why I didn't return to Chicago, but went to the University of Leeds to the Middle Eastern Studies Department. I didn't go to the Art History Department, which at Leeds is very famous, but I went to the Middle Eastern Studies Department and got my PhD in Islamic Studies because I wanted to devote myself to knowing more about Islam. And it's really from there that I've constantly kept my pursuit within Islamic art history as someone who engages above all in thinking about how the discourses of Islam help can help us see and understand the objects that have been produced, the material culture that's been produced within Islamic cultures. And I found that my background in Islamic studies has been very helpful in trying to look at Islamic art from, if you like, more from within the culture than, so more from an emic perspective than an itic perspective, I suppose we'd say, that more from within the cultural terms in which it was produced rather than within the academic terms which Islamic art history, for the most part, operates with. That's really my trajectory, and it has remained my trajectory. And I came to write this book on the Kaaba because, well, I found that it simply hadn't been covered, and I couldn't understand this. I couldn't understand how the building that most Muslims would probably say is the most important building in the Islamic world. I was at a loss to understand how this building didn't have much coverage in Islamic art history. A few articles had been written about it, but from the architectural aspect of Islamic art history, it really was not covered at all. And if one measures the importance of monuments by how many monographs have been written about them, then, you know, I found it staggering that the Kaaba had not a single monograph in any European language about it. Whereas, for example, if you look at the Dome of the Rock, it has numerous monographs written about it. The Umayyad Mosque of Damascus is not short of monographs, but the Kaaba had nothing. I felt that this was something that a lacuna that needed addressing. And I felt that my background in Islamic studies might allow me to engage with it in ways that might reveal interesting insights about it. So my book is very much a book that looks at the Kaaba from the perspective of Muslims. It is, you know, how have Muslims thought about it? How have they written about it? How have they represented it? How have they dreamt about it? How have they written poetry about it? I wanted to know how this building had been used and still is used from the beginning of the Islamic period, or at least the period when we can start getting we start having textual evidence and other evidence that we can refer to up till by and large the 18th century. I don't really go into modernity because it's a very, well, I only had 90,000 words, and modernity I felt was a step too far.
Thank you very much, and apologies for the mistake earlier. You've started to enter in the topic of the book itself, which is, as you said, the Kaaba, which is the central granite cuboid structure at the center of the Grand Mosque in Mecca. And I before we delve into the six chapters of your book, I just wanted to say and to note and to congratulate you on really the how wonderful the book is in all respects. It is a fantastic work of scholarship, a fantastic work of publishing. It is a beautifully organized, beautifully written book. Congratulations to you. Congratulations to Edinburgh University Press as well, and to your editors. It was a joy to read, and it will be a joy to talk to you about it. You've divided your book in six chapters, as you were saying, each of them looking at different ways that that the Kaaba was understood or is understood. The first one is, you call it the Kaaba as Qibla. Can you tell us something more about that? Maybe also even explaining what Qibla means to listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Of course, I'm happy to do so. And before I do so, just thank you for your lovely words. It's very, one can never hear enough nice words about something that one's done, at whatever stage one is in one's academic career. Anyway, so thank you very much. I'm glad I'm very glad to hear your positive appreciation of the book. In terms of the Qibla in the first chapter, well, first of all, the Qibla then, for those who don't know, is the sacred direction in Islam. So it's the direction which many of the ritual actions that are prescribed for religious life for Muslims in Islam, they have to be directed towards the Kaaba in Mecca. So, for example, daily prayer, salat, has to be, you have to be oriented in the direction of the Kaaba for your prayer to be accepted by God. Of course, if you accidentally, if you don't know the direction of Kaaba and you find yourself later that you were pointing in the wrong direction, that doesn't matter. But you need to make the effort to try and locate the Kaaba, and then direct your prayers in that direction. And there are other ritual actions which are also meant to be done facing the Kaaba. And lastly, when a Muslim dies, they are buried with their face in the direction of the Kaaba. And that direction is called the Qibla, and we could think of it simply as sacred direction. Now, I started with my first chapter, and it's called the Kaaba as Qibla, as you say, because my guiding how I worked my way through these different chapters was I was trying to think, how does the Kaaba work in Islamic culture? How has it worked in the past, and to some extent, how is it still working today? I was interested to know its effects, what it had made possible within Islamic culture. So I wanted to know, in a sense, how it was being used and how it was working within the culture. And I thought that the Qibla was a good place to start, because without the Kaaba, there wouldn't be a Qibla, so to speak. There might be a Qibla elsewhere, as we know that prior to the Kaaba being the Qibla of Islam, we know that Jerusalem was the Qibla of Islam, for example. But the Qibla is, if you like, the way that most Muslims in their daily life daily interact with the Kaaba, because they do their ritual prayer in the direction of it. So it seemed like a good place to start to think about, quote unquote, the work of the Kaaba in daily life, because that's what I was interested in. I want to know how it was working, what it was doing within Islamic culture. So I chose the Qibla to start off with, because I felt that most, that would be a usage that would involve most Muslims, even if they'd never seen the Kaaba. When they orient themselves towards it in prayer, they are using it, and the Kaaba is working on their behalves, effectively, because the Kaaba provides the focal point of their prayers. It's a kind of, and then via the Kaaba, the prayer is channeled up to God, because the Kaaba is God's house. So you direct your prayer with a horizontal vector, and because it's God's house, there is a vertical vector, which we don't see, that takes the prayer, one hopes, to heaven and God. So that was how I chose it. I was astonished. I had an inkling about this, but I've always been interested in the fact that early in the history of Islamic urbanism, in fact, very early in the history of Islamic urbanism, cities, or what we call garrison cities, the Amsar, these cities that were built for the conquest of Iraq, the conquest of Iran, the conquest of Egypt, these garrison cities that were built after the death of the Prophet, when the armies of Islam spread out to take the word of Islam with them, I was struck that a number of these garrison towns had a Qibla orientation, either at their very center or the entirety of the city itself. And I was struck by this, why would armies, we expect them to be kind of, by definition, they are going to be engaging in warfare, and they're going to be, violence is going to be perpetuated by them. Why would they bother with such a thing as making sure their city is oriented in the direction of the Kaaba? That thinking about and looking into the organization of early Islamic urban space, I found more than a handful of early cities, not just the Amsar, not just the garrison towns, but also later cities, had a quite noticeable Kaaba orientation, quite a noticeable Qibla orientation to them, in that either they were oriented at the center towards the Kaaba, and the rest of the city was too sprawling to have that orientation. Or indeed, some actually had a Kaaba / Qibla direction throughout them. You know, and I've always found that, and I still find that to be astonishing, that people would go to such effort to make sure that their urban life, which we might normally think of as being secular, actually has a kind of religious element to it, even though they're not praying in mosques, for example. But the city itself has been laid out with this Qibla in mind.
Thank you. This is fascinating on many levels, and very much especially given your argument, and I think very strong argument, as you said, for the very early use of the Qibla throughout the nascent Islamic world at that time. The second chapter, of course, it necessarily connects, but it's a different angle looking at the Kaaba. You name it as a navel of the world, and it is largely a cosmological exploration of the place of the Kaaba in the world. And could you tell us how that follows from that idea of orientation, how that differs, or just something about that?
Well, it's two different sets of material, shall we say, two different sets of literature that I was looking at. In the first one, to do with the Qibla, for the most part, I was looking at archaeological records and the earliest Islamic histories that we have. That was a very textual study. In the second one, in many ways, the prime document were maps that had been made. So a later period, but maps that were cosmological in their in their outlook. So these were maps that were put together by cosmographers in the sort of 13th, 14th century, maybe based on earlier cosmographies, but they placed the Kaaba right at the center of the world, which was reproduced in these maps.
And so, let me just slightly interrupt to say that the book is lavish reproductions of plates with those maps, and they were really a wonderful treasure. Please continue. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yes, as you say, the editorial team have done a great job in the reproductions. I was fascinated by this anchoring of the Kaaba right at the center of these representations of the world. After all, these are maps put together by cosmographers who are claiming to represent the world, including the Islamic world within it. And there was the Kaaba right at the center. I then found a parallel with that, with early traditions. They're not hadith, they don't go back to the Prophet, but they're very early traditions that we can take back to at least the 9th century, that talk of the Kaaba being the origin point of the world. And that's a kind of, that parallels very nicely with these maps, these cosmographies, these representations of cosmographies, because in these maps, very much one gets the sense that the world is uncoiling from the Kaaba, as if it were being born from there, as if it were a matrix of sorts. And the idea of the Kaaba as being the birthing site of the world is precisely what we find in these 9th century traditions that say very carefully, very deliberately, that the world was spread out from underneath the Kaaba. And I found the image of being birthed from underneath to be exactly that which one would expect in this period when it comes to thinking about birthing. In this period, you were birthed vertically. You know, you were a woman stood, and the child came out from underneath her. So there's very much a sense. I certainly find it difficult not to see in these traditions some kind of birthing imagery at play, and I found that also reflected in these representations of the world in which the Kaaba was dead center. And it It relates to the first chapter because the first chapter is about the organization of space. But I was talking about urban space. The second chapter is about the organization of world space. So, you know, in the first chapter, I was looking at how urban sites had been oriented towards the Kaaba, either just at the very center or in an urban site's totality. And in the second chapter, I was looking at how the world was said to be oriented to the Kaaba. So both link, both chapters tie to each other, but one was focused on cities, whereas the second one is, quote unquote, focused on the world, because the Kaaba is said to have birthed the world and to orient the world as a whole. Everything is oriented towards it in these traditions and in these maps, these mappa mundi, these world maps.
Thank you. That's the idea of a space and a location and a building that exists in a location, which is the axis of the world, brings us to your third chapter, which you named the Kaaba as a substructure, which approaches that problem from the perspective of the event of what happens to the space. What's the relationship between the space itself and the building which is in it, and specifically what happens when the building is destroyed? I found it, the entire book is fascinating. This one was particularly touching. Could you make some connections concerning what you meant by substructure and the and all of this?
Yes, of course. The third chapter develops, shall we say, what was put forward in the second chapter. That in the second chapter, the Kaaba is the center of the world. It's the navel, and it also seems to have birthed the world. So it's both a navel and a matrix. And then I wondered, and it's a pivot as such. It's the pivot of the universe. And in some representations, it's the pivot of the whole universe. So in chapter two, there is a representation of the universe as a whole in which the Kaaba is dead center and seems to be birthing the whole universe. And certainly the universe seems to pivot on this. As you say, the representations are very good in this book. I'm very glad that they've done so well. They've been done so well. Anyway, so the third chapter is an inquiry to do with the fact that, well, if it is the pivot of the world, if it's the navel and the axis mundi, we know that the Kaaba has been, we know that even on a conservative reckoning, by a conservative reckoning, the Kaaba that stands today in Mecca is the 11th reconstruction of it. And I think that's a very conservative reckoning. It's a reckoning by a Saudi scholar. I suspect that the number of reconstructions the Kaaba has endured is much closer to 20, I would guess. Anyway, the point is that the Kaaba has been destroyed on a number of occasions, mostly by flooding, sometimes by fire, but also by warfare. And it gets completely destroyed. And I asked myself, well, hang on, if the Kaaba is the pivot of the world, what happens if that pivot gets smashed? Wouldn't that leave the world off axis and kind of spinning uncontrollably? So that led me into a kind of inquiry into thinking, well, perhaps it's not the Kaaba that stands on the surface that we need to worry about, but maybe there's something about its foundations that is more important. So not necessarily the superstructure of the Kaaba, but its substructure, the foundations. And we know that those foundations are important because one of the few places where the Kaaba is spoken of in the Quran is when Abraham raises the foundations. And so we get this word kawa'id, and we know that these foundations are important because the Quran tells us how Abraham raises, with Ishmael, raises the foundations. So the third chapter is looking at the foundations of the Kaaba, what we know about them, and what those foundations tell us about what ultimately matters about the Kaaba. And in my conclusion is that ultimately it's those foundations that have never been destroyed. They have always remained consistent. They've never, at least according to the at least according to representations of the Kaaba, both textual and pictorial, those foundations, the substructure has never been destroyed, unlike the superstructure. And that is quite different to, say, the temple in Jerusalem, where we get in Lamentations, we're told that the fire reaches down and destroys even the foundations. And I think that's, you know, people often say, oh, the Kaaba is just some borrowing of the temple in Jerusalem. It's a kind of copy of it. I'm not arguing with that whole thing. That's a debate that needs to be looked at very carefully. But certainly, it's one thing that it does not borrow from the temple is the idea that the foundations are destroyed. Jeremiah tells us the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed right down to its foundations. That is not what happens at the Kaaba. It's in that regard, it's quite different, I think, to the temple in Jerusalem.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. The fourth chapter, I read it as a different way of looking at the space of the Kaaba as it relates to a building which is there, which is what we call the Kaaba. You were just now talking about how that can be looked at in a different way, through an axis, through a substructure, a superstructure. In the fourth, you look at, which is called the Kaaba as beloved. You look at personal reactions, sometimes of ecstatic, sometimes even of erotic imagery that people used and experienced when in contact with that space. You also made a connection at one point about how that was sometimes used as a way of dealing with the trauma of destruction. What does that mean for the Kaaba to be as a beloved in this context?
Yes, well, as you say, there is a kind of, in some sense, there's not a sea change, but there's a change between chapters 1 to 3 and then 4 onwards. In chapter 4, I look not so much at how it's been represented in historical documents, but in terms of how people have written histories of it, but I look at how it's actually used physically, I look at its main usage during pilgrimage season, and not just the Hajj, but also the lesser pilgrimage, the Umrah. I look at the fact that, so the focus of it, of chapter 4, is the circumambulation ritual, the tawaf of the Kaaba. And that's its main usage. Remember, this book is about how the Kaaba has been used and is used by Muslims. It's used as a sacred direction. So that's the Qibla and Salat. And in chapter 4, it's used extensively as the object, as used as God's house, around which pilgrims circumambulate 7 times every time they perform the tawaf or circumambulation ritual. Now, that tawaf, I was trying to dig out experiences of that tawaf. I was trying to get to how people have experienced this tawaf, what their experiences could tell us about the Kaaba, in the hope that somehow there would be some kind of connection between their experiences, which might help us shed light on how the Kaaba was understood and is understood by Muslims. There isn't much literature well, in fact, there's very little literature on this experiential aspect of the Kaaba prior to, shall we say, the 19th century, except for within what you call ecstatic writings, Sufism. And so the literature that I look at in chapter four is extensively comprises Sufi literature, because they have spoken of what they experienced as they circumambulated the house of God. And for me, that was there's very little. When we deal with pre-modern Islamic architecture, we don't really have many sources that can tell us how it was experienced. So, although I know and expect to be told, oh, Simon, you've put too much emphasis on Sufism, partly I say, yes, that's true, but that's because we don't have many other sources for experiential accounts of architecture, not for pre-modernity. But also, let's be careful before we start dividing Islam into, Sufism and non-Sufism, Salafi and orthodoxy, and all these divisions that we use today. I mean, I think the scholarship increasingly is coming out in the direction that Sufism is really a part and parcel of Islam. And so, yes, it's true that I use Sufi documentation in this chapter, and you can hear that I'm being slightly defensive about it already. But I would say, and others have said it better before me, that Sufism is not some kind of add-on to Islam. It's part and parcel of Islam. So I shift into looking at Sufi literature a lot, and I specifically focus on the longest account of the Tawaf that I'm aware of, which is a very long discussion of experiencing the Kaaba by the Andalusian mystic. He wasn't a Sufi, or at least he never identified as a Sufi, Ibn Arabi, who dies in the 13th century. And he wrote an extensive account of his two or three encounters with the Kaaba, where mystical events happened to him. And so I use that as the basis for my engagement with the Kaaba as the beloved, which I argue the pilgrim, specifically the Sufi pilgrim, is trying to bond with. Referring to the Kaaba as beloved is not specifically a Sufi trope. You can refer to the Kaaba as beloved without being a Sufi. But it is particularly common in Sufism to refer to the house of God as the beloved. And the argument I make in this chapter is that the Tawaf effectuates a bonding of it, almost like the thread of a screw. When you're circling, it's almost like you're bond. It's almost like you're threading yourself into the wall of the Kaaba. You're threading yourself around it. You're bonding yourself to it through the action of circling. And that's the conclusion that I reach about what Tawaf is doing, at least within a Sufi context, based upon this long experiential account by Ibn Arabi. But it's not, and I should add, it's not just based on Ibn Arabi. I try to place Ibn Arabi's experiential account of the Tawaf in the context of other Sufis' accounts in order to show, again defensively, that Ibn Arabi is not some outlier in the mystical literature, that he was a part and parcel of, he was writing, his experiential accounts are longer than other people's, but are not necessarily different in terms of content. So I do try to anchor Ibn Arabi into a wider Sufi context, and you can hear it in my defensiveness now, in order to try and ward off the what I know is going to be said, oh, Simon, we can dismiss chapter four because it just refers to that heretical Ibn Arabi who people dismiss as being a Muslim anyway. And that simply isn't the case.
Yes, You bring Ibn Arabi in connection with a number of other reports. That was very much clear. I did not get the feeling that was a one man event in the relation of the Kaaba as a in the
perfect.
Yes. Perfect. I found it curious because the way you were talking now reflected also the naming of the chapters from one to four. You have the Kaaba as Qibla, the Kaaba as Navel, the Kaaba as substructure, the Kaaba as beloved, and in the fifth you call it the house as holder. And right now you are also switching to the use of house. Is this something that you feel has significance, or is the ancient house or Beit al-Atiq is this something that there is to the name, or is it different ways of referring?
The Beit is the most common way of referring to the Kaaba in the Quran, which of course has led scholars rightly to question whether the signified is the Kaaba in Mecca or just some other temple somewhere else. The Kaaba is mentioned, but it's mentioned very infrequently. You forgive me, I can't remember. I think it's twice it's mentioned by name in the Quran. But the Beit is the more common word, Beit al-Atiq, and various forms of al-Beit, various qualifications of it, is more common. Do I think that there's a distinction between the two? No. The reason I move to discussing in chapter 5, I start my chapters not with the word the Kaaba, but with the house, is because in chapters 5 and 6, I'm looking at another usage of the Kaaba, which is as architecture, it holds. Architecture is said, its prime function of architecture is to house and contain and give shelter. So I moved the title in chapters 5 and 6 to house, not the Kaaba, in order to kind of prepare the reader to thinking about housing and how the Kaaba houses and if it houses. So that's why I shift to a different usage. It's reflected in the Quran. It's reflected in the literature. People can be talking about the Kaaba in one breath and then the house in another. I don't think in that shifting that anything significant is taking place. I think it's just two ways of referring to the same building. I don't think it's reflective of some deeper significance. For me, in chapter 5 and 6, it's merely to prepare the reader for a topic that chapters 5 and 6 both speak to, which is what is the Kaaba doing in its form as architecture? If we expect architecture to house and hold, give shelter, does the Kaaba do that? And that was prompted, and that question has been prompted, has been prompted by two or three occasions when I've spoken about the Kaaba in lectures as I was, I've been researching this for quite a long time, in fact, for a very long time, too long, although one needs to do a long research, I think, on a building is important to this. But I started researching it in 2010, and I was lucky enough to be in Florence on a scholarship there at the Kunsthistorische Institute, and I gave a lecture about some of my research, and I was astonished to find one of the big cheeses, who was an invited guest, not part of the institute, saying at the end of it, saying, yes, but the Kaaba doesn't count as architecture. And that has been repeated to me at two other lectures since, somehow the Kaaba is not architecture. Foolishly, on these three occasions, I have never had the wit to say, what do you mean? I've just ended up saying, yes, of course it is. But I should have put the question back to the questioner. But I suspect what underlies their accusation is that we tend to think of architecture as having elaborate ornamentation, having a program of ornamentation, some kind of iconographic program. And the Kaaba, as we all know, is almost bereft of ornamentation. It has a door. It has some lines of tiraz bands on it, but it is, it doesn't, it's almost like a shed, if you like, and probably we would hesitate to call a shed architecture, or at least high-minded art historians would probably hesitate to call a shed architecture. Personally, a shed is architecture in my view, and I'm not saying the Kaaba is a shed, I hasten to add, but I felt it very important to address in chapters 5 and 6 the fact that the Kaaba is architecture. in the fact that it's doing what architecture does, which is holding. What it holds is another matter entirely. And that's what I try and pursue in chapter 5 specifically. And then in chapter 6, I look at, you know, how that holding function is signified by the kiswa, or the black robe that covers the Kaaba. But both 5 and 6 address the holding nature of the Kaaba. And that's why I use the word house in the chapter. Sorry, that's a long answer to your pertinent question.
It is. It was a wonderful answer. The question of what constitutes architecture is, of course, a long one. But you do go to length in the book to explain how the very structure of the Kaaba is extensively debated and described. The walls, the divisions, the sides, the corners, the height, the depths. That's something that Muslim writers describe and engage with profoundly in all sorts of ways that are many of which you engage in the book here. So that question, it does sound very strange after having read your book. How could this not be architecture? But yes, but coming back to your fifth chapter, the house as a holder, as you were explaining, one of the functions of a house or of a building, of a house specifically, is to hold. So what does the Kaaba hold?
Well, exactly. In my view, it holds the mystery. It holds nothing, where nothing should be understood as this mystical number, not number. I mean, what is the number zero? And there's, so towards the end of that chapter, I do go out on a limb and interpret the emptiness of the Kaaba in terms of zero, right? I talk about the entry of zero into the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century. I talk about the history of zero. But again, I should add that is, you know, there are some places in the book where I do give my personal interpretation, and that's definitely one of the places where I go out on a limb, because I have not found in the literature and in my readings from emic sources, from within Muslim literature, I have not found the Kaaba being spoken of as a holder of the number zero or nothingness, holding nothing. And so I keep that interpretation towards the end of the chapter, but prior to that, I stay very much with literature and representations and documents that have come from within Islamic culture to look at what the Kaaba held before the Prophet returned in victory to Mecca. So he returns in victory in 630. It's the conquest of Mecca. And at that point, Mecca becomes an Islamic city, so to speak. And the Kaaba is emptied of the whatever it contained. Now, the literature on what it contains is not uniform, so I kind of pass that literature. I go through it to look at what are the dominant strands of these different histories that have spoken of this event of the cleansing of the Kaaba, to try and find out what it held prior to the Prophet's conquest in 630. But if there's doubt about, if there's confusion about what was inside it and what was around the Kaaba before 630, there's no doubt that after 630, it doesn't hold anything. The sources are clear about that. If the sources discuss the cleansing of the Kaaba in 630, there may be confusion about what it contained. Now, did it contain a goat's head? Did it contain a dove? Did it contain hubal? Did it contain moored idols? There might be confusion about that, but there isn't confusion about the fact that after it's been cleansed, it doesn't contain anything. And it's that nothingness that I'm interested in, because I argue, this is when I start moving into an interpretive mode, because I say that nothingness is, we can see that emptiness in a certain genre of representations, of paintings of the Kaaba. There is a prayer book, a very famous prayer book by Al-Jazuli, a Moroccan Sufi, who writes Dalail al-Khairat, which gets variously translated. I translated as the guidelines to blessings, but its translation is often often changes. In this manuscript, which it gets copied very quickly and gets repeatedly copied, it's a very popular book. And when it gets copied increasingly, especially from around the 16th century, and even more especially from the 18th century, we start finding paired diagrams of the Kaaba, of Mecca and Medina, the Haramain, the two sacred precincts. And I look at the way that in this particular prayer book, in the copies of it, how the Kaaba is routinely represented in a very particular way that is unusual, in my view, in comparison to other buildings in the same prayer manuscript, but indeed other representations of, say, the Dome of the Rock. So I make comparisons between how the Kaaba is represented in this prayer book vis-a-vis how it's represented, say, in guidebooks to Jerusalem. And I argue that it's represented in this way because there is nothing in the Kaaba to represent. And that then leads me to the final part of the chapter where I talk about the progress of the number zero from India into Arabia in the 7th century, and you know, how we might think of the nothingness within the Kaaba as actually being constitutive of the mystery of the Kaaba. After all, nothing is itself is a mystical thing. It's a source of mystery, but it's also the beginning point of numbers. For example, naught anchors the numbers 1 to 9. I'm sorry, naught in Renaissance art history anchors the linear perspective from which we get the illusion of three-dimensional space on a two-dimensional surface. Naught anchors monetary systems that are used in capitalism today. There is quite a lot of interesting writing about naught and zero by mathematicians. And I make reference to those and go out on a limb talking about this, the nothing that the Kaaba contains. It's a placeholder for nothing.
That was amazing. Thank you very much. I think it really, really drove the point home that you were making earlier about the uniqueness of the Kaaba as world architecture. The comparisons, again, represented in plates throughout the book of different maps representing the Kaaba and other supposedly comparable buildings, including other Islamic buildings at Medina and so on.
Great.
On the note of emptiness, you talk about the Kiswa. The Kiswa is the by now yearly, if I'm not mistaken, changed mm-hmm. robe of the Kaaba.
Yes.
And you explain how maybe it wasn't always yearly, or you talk about that, but you specifically talk about the role of the Kiswa in constituting the Kaaba, as you call it, as a dwelling.
Yes.
This is the final chapter of your book. Could you tell us something about that?
Yes. So this chapter, which I now look at how the Kaaba is imagined by certain communities, shall we say, it's imagined by certain groups of people. I need to be very careful. What I'm saying here is, I'm not saying that it's imagined by the ulema. I'm not saying it's imagined by the Saudi king today, but I look at how the Kaaba has been imagined by travelers, by miniature painters in Iran, and by Sufis, how it's imagined to contain at a certain point of the Islamic calendar, it's imagined to be alive. It's imagined to be a dwelling of something superabundant. And this, I argue, is signified in the way that the kiswa, the robe, is hung. The Kiswah is not consistently down to the ground. It is just before the Hajj season. It's elevated a short a distance. It changes. Again, the travelers' accounts tell us the different ways that it is elevated, but it's elevated just before the Hajj commences, and it's wrapped. And where it's elevated, then a white cloth is then wrapped around it. And we know from at least Ibn Battuta's period, and in fact even earlier, we know from Ibn Jubayr, so in the 12th century, we know that when it's got this white robe around it, an izar is another word for the costume that pilgrims have to wear, that it's called, it's said that the Kaaba is now in its ihram, it's now in its state of taboo, it's wearing pilgrimage clothes. So when it gets wrapped with this white cloth, and when the Kiswah has been elevated and then a white cloth is wrapped around it, it's said to be in a state of ihram. Then then on the day of Arafat, day four of the Hajj, the Kiswah is replaced with a new Kiswah. And it is lowered, but is not lowered completely down to the ground again. It is then hung in a different way once again. And we've got from Persian paintings, from miniature paintings, from Iran, and I separate them from Ottoman miniature paintings, where we don't see an interest in the Kiswah. But in Persian paintings, we get a sort of almost a sustained focus on the way that the Kiswah is hung when it's been replaced with a new one. And at this point, the literature, we know from literature, travelers again, that the Kaaba is referred to as a bride. So from travel literature, we know that there is a period when it seems to either be a pilgrim or a bride. So it seems to be sort of a living thing, but it's also completely closed off during this period. You can't go into the Kaaba during this period. It's completely shut. And in these miniature paintings, which show the Kaaba in its bridal costume, at the same time as showing it in this way, the rest of the miniature painting is showing events that are cosmically inspired. There are angels dancing, there are angels whirling around. Maybe the prophet is riding over it in passage to Jerusalem as part of the Mi'raj. Maybe the prophet is smashing some idols to mark the end of idolatry and the commencement of Tawheed and Islam. I argue that these cosmic events and the fact that the Kaaba is dressed in this bridal gear and this elaborate costume is suggestive of a fact that the Kaaba this moment is an actor in the scene, and it's alive. It's almost as if it were itself animated with a superabundant force. So the evidence for that, to say, just to make sure that your listeners aren't thinking this, you know, this person is just kind of
our.
thank you. It's just running wild with one or two ideas. The evidence is all based either on miniature painting, on travelers' reports, on Sufi accounts, again, because they're the ones that most attentive to encounters with the Kaaba. European travelers who traveled to Mecca in the 19th century, they've also left us very careful accounts of the hanging of the Kiswah around the Hajj period. So I found them to be very valuable too. And because the book is so nicely illustrated, you know, when I'm referring to this or that painting, the reader can look at it themselves without having to go on the internet. So you can see that this argument is evidence-based. Sometimes the evidence is pictorial, which if you're a historian may not count so much, but the reader will be able to see that this is not just kind of fancy, not just whimsy, because it is possible. It's all too easy to write whimsically about the Kaaba. You can fantasize about it, and I don't think any of our readers, any of our listeners, or any reader, any academic reader wants to read whimsy when it comes to the Kaaba.
Specifically about readers and academic readers, I think another thing that readers of your book will certainly appreciate, I appreciated it very much, was the lucid structure with which you organize each chapter, materializing the conclusions of each chapter at the end, your own personal conclusions, what you consider to be general, and then at the end, at the conclusion again, very clearly stating your position and in a condensed format. I found that very helpful. I found it was a very helpful device for an intellectual engagement with the book, and I wanted to commend you for that.
Thank you.
Right now we're not looking to take much more of your time, but I wanted to ask you, after this amazing book, what are you working on? Is there some other book you're working on? Is there some projects? What's your horizon right now?
Well, thank you. Yes, I need to be thinking about a new project, and it will again involve architecture. I have this kind of fascination with what architecture is and what it does, not just in Islamic culture, but in any culture. And I think, although I'm not absolutely sure yet, I think what I want to do for my next project is think about how the Quran, how the Hadith, and in a sense more broadly, how Islamic culture thinks in terms of architecture. I'm interested in the way that we get Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Sulh. House imagery is used to divide the world. The afterlife is called a house. This life is called a house. And so I'm going to be doing a project which isn't necessarily focused on a real object, like the Kaaba is a real object, but I'm going to be looking in almost, it's going to be again quite conceptual in that I want to see how architecture is being used in the Quran, how it's being used in the Hadith, in traditions and so forth, to structure ideas, to structure thought, and indeed to structure this world and the world to come. As I say, the word house is a dominant form of structuring. It's an architectural way of thinking. And that's really my interest. My interest is architecture. It has always been. And if there's one thing that Islamic art and architecture excels at, in my view, it's architecture. I mean, you can see Islamic architecture still today leaves me in awe. Not all of it, but it is a tremendous achievement within the material culture of the Islamic world. And that's what I think is where I'm going to be going. But it almost certainly won't be looking at a particular building. I want to look at how it structures, particularly this divide between the world, the alam shahada, the seen world, and the alam araib, the unseen world. What that divide is, it's an architectural divide of some sort. What gets secreted, what can't be seen in this world, what is pushed out of sight by the house. After all, the house holds and contains and puts out of sight, puts out of view. So you can see that in some sense, it'll be familiar to anyone who's read a few of the chapters of the present book, a kind of similar way of engaging with architecture. Others will say, not for me, because it's too conceptual. I understand that. But that's where I think I'm going. I want to do something conceptual about housing and housing as a way of organizing the Islamic world.
I hope to be here to talk to you about that future book.
Thank you.
One thing I wanted to note also was that Edinburgh University Press was kind enough to provide us with a code for a 30% discount for if people want to buy your book. And that's podcast 30. That's podcast 30. So I wanted to leave that here. But apart from that, I wanted to thank you tremendously for your time and for the wonderful book you've added to the scholarship. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
Miguel, the pleasure is entirely mine. Thank you very much, and all the very best with your studies. I hope our paths cross in person. Thank you for having me. It's been a tremendous honor and pleasure.
Thank you very much. My name is Miguel Montero, and we were just with the New Books Network in Middle Eastern Studies. Thank you very much.